Hi, I'm CJ, a millennial. You may know me from the podcast Science with Millennials. Well, you'd be correct, but this time we're coming at you with something other than science. We're going to be utilizing Rachel's forensic science degree and my psych knowledge to bring you a podcast that will be both thrilling and chilling.
If you haven't guessed from the title, we're going to be talking about true crime. I absolutely love learning about different true crime cases and have a plethora of knowledge pent up in my brain about cases I've read about, listened to, and watched on TV. So we're going to be utilizing my forensic chemistry degree as well as CJ's psych knowledge. As a reminder, CJ doesn't know what the case is before recording the episodes, so it's a mystery for you and her. Let's open today's case file and see what's in store. Welcome to True Crime with Millennials. All right, CJ, are you ready for me to tell you a story?
Oh, I'm so ready.
All right, so we're going to set the stage. It's July 27th, 1996, the year I was born, in Atlanta, Georgia. The Summer Olympics are happening. Around 15,000 people are gathered in Centennial Olympic Park watching Jack Mack and the Heart Attack in concert. So, you know, right off the bat, we've set the scene. It's a summer concert. It's, you know, it's been pretty hot. It's Atlanta, Georgia. It's just cooling down for the night. And this concert was late at night. So it's, you know, in the middle of the night. It's like midnight on.
Why do I feel like this is like a scary story? Like I'm saying it all creepy like too, so it's like intense.
At 12:58, a 911 call is received saying, "There's a bomb in Centennial Park. You have 30 minutes." And then the caller hung up. At the same time that this call was happening, a 33-year-old security guard near the sound and light tower of the stage named Richard Jewell was with a GBI agent named Tom Davis. GBI, for those of you who are not true crime aficionados, is the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. Every state has their own, like, mini FBI, and it's usually just the state. And then Bureau of Investigation. So Richard Jewell and Tom Davis are dealing with some rowdy, drunk, you know, like 18-year-olds or whatever. And they, you know, are having a hard time getting them to leave. And then when they finally do leave, they notice that they've left this bag behind. It's a military green Alice pack, which is apparently like a very large like backpack type thing that military people carry. So as the rowdy drunk boys are walking off, they call after them like, "Oh hey, you left your bag." And they say, "Oh no, that's not ours. That was there when we got here." So Richard Jewell and Tom Davis begin to ask around all the other people nearby like, "Oh, is this your bag? Is this your bag?" Eventually they've established that nobody wants to claim the bag. And so they follow protocol and they report this as a suspicious package, basically, and call in the bomb squad. After they call for the bomb squad, they set up a 15-foot perimeter around the bag. The bomb squad came and identified that it was indeed a large bomb. They began to evacuate everyone. However, at 1:20 in the morning, the bomb went off, which was actually 22 minutes from when the caller called 911 and said that there was a bomb and that they had 30 minutes. So the bomb went off. They were not able to finish the evacuation in time. 111 people were injured in the blast. A 44-year-old woman named Alice Hawthorne from Albany, New York, was hit with shrapnel 6 times, including a fatal wound to her head. She was at the Olympics with her daughter. They had driven down to witness the Olympics. A Turkish news cameraman named, I'm sorry, I'm going to pronounce this so wrong, Mila Uzunul, died of a heart attack while rushing to the scene. And as I said, 111 other people were injured in the blast. The GBI agent, Tom Davis, was hit with shrapnel in the butt but his badge was in his back pocket and it stopped the shrapnel from injuring him. So obviously there's 15,000 people in this park right now and a bomb just went off. And it was a pretty big bomb, so, you know, chaos is ensuing. Richard Jewell rushes to help people that are injured. So do the GBI agents and everybody else that's there. You know, everybody's just trying to do what they can to help people and also, like, try to make sure there's not any more of a threat. Richard Jewell is actually the first one who noticed the backpack. As such, he is touted by the media as being a hero. He is the one that noticed it. He helped start the evacuation process in advance, because if they hadn't started evacuating, even more people would have probably died, and, you know, it would have been a much worse situation. He also helped in the aftermath, make sure that people got the help they needed and stuff like that. So he begins to be interviewed by the media, as happens in any case like this where it's a big deal and there's someone involved. You know, the media is going to try to get every interview they can. A man named Ray Clear called the FBI and said that he was suspicious of Richard Jewell. And
yeah, I was going to say that something's up there.
And said that he had information about improper conduct of Jewell when he worked for a university. It turns out that Ray Clear was a part of this university as well. So obviously the police are interested in this information. They do a little more research on Richard Jewell and find out that he wanted to be a cop. He's been arrested for impersonating an officer. He was a deputy sheriff for 5 years, in which time he wrecked 4 cop cars and then was kind of forced to resign.
How do you wreck 4 cop cars?
I don't know. Apparently he was very, very enthusiastic about being a police officer.
Is he trying to Dukes of Hazzard the freaking cars or what?
When he worked at the university, he would constantly report or like pull people over for like super minor traffic infractions, like anything he could do to feel like a police officer. And it came out that he had joked to a friend that, or if anything happened at the games, he wanted to be in the middle of it. In case you're wondering what I think of Ray Clear, the guy who told the FBI about Jewell, I think he's a big old bitch. He's a snitch and I hate him. Anyway.
He's a narc, is what you're saying.
Mind your own business. Like, anyway, by Monday morning, the FBI's behavioral specialists had said that Jewell fit the profile of someone who would detonate a bomb to appear a hero. A GBI agent that Jewell knew, named Tim Attaway, wore a wire. Well, it wasn't really a sophisticated wire. It was literally like a cassette tape recorder, like taped to his back. But anyway, he had called Jewell acting homesick, so Jewell invited him over for lasagna. When he went over to visit Jewell, he wore a wire to try to get him to say anything incriminating about the bombing. And Jewell did talk about the bombing all night. They stayed up till 1 a.m. talking about it, but never made any incriminating statements. The story of Jewell being suspected quickly hit the news, and it spread like wildfire. You know, it's a very spicy story for, like, the guy that's been touted as a hero to actually be the bomber. He was branded as a badge-wearing zealot and a bad man to cross on his beat. He was also compared to Wayne Williams, who is another bad, bad person that we will probably talk about at some point. Jewell was then surveyed by the FBI, literally followed everywhere he went for the next several months. Finally, the attorney general told the FBI that it needed to review the case and either, you know, arrest him or leave him alone. On October 6th, the FBI interviewed Jewell for 6 hours. Almost a month later, he finally was told that he was no longer a suspect in the case. I'm sure that he very much regretted joking to a friend that if anything happened at the games, he wanted to be in the middle of it. It turned out that a media outlet in the area had taken some liberties with the truth and basically drug this poor man's name through the mud. And also it turned out that he was literally with a Georgia Bureau of Investigation officer at the time the 911 phone call was made.
Ah, so it couldn't have been him.
Right. I mean, like, I guess he could have had an accomplice, but he was ruled out as a suspect. 6 months after the Olympics pipe bomb, the bomb was actually 3 pipe bombs filled with gunpowder and 6 pounds of 2.5-inch nails as shrapnel. 6 months after the Olympics pipe bomb, another pipe bomb was set off in another part of Atlanta, outside of an abortion clinic.
What is a pipe bomb, though?
So a pipe bomb is pretty much what it sounds like. It's a usually like aluminum pipe or like some type of metal pipe, but I guess you could make one with like a PVC pipe. I don't really know. I'm not super into bomb making. But it's literally a pipe that they pack with explosive, so gunpowder in this case. And he had surrounded the gunpowder with the nails to make shrapnel. So then when the gunpowder explodes, it shoots these, they become projectiles into the surrounding area.
Okay. So it's like a, not like a gun, but kind of like a machine gun coming from a bomb?
Not really. I mean, so basically a pipe bomb is like any other bomb. A pipe is just what it's encased in.
I guess I'm just thinking of, like, the nails and shrapnel going everywhere. They're kind of like little mini bullets.
Yeah, I mean, but that's usually the case with any bomb, usually. The goal is to hurt as many people as possible, and thus, shrapnel is usually used.
You can tell how much I pay attention to weaponry by this conversation.
6 months after the Olympics bomb went off, another one was set off in another part of Atlanta outside of an abortion clinic. Then following that, on February 21st, 1997, a bomb behind the Other Side Lounge, which is a lesbian bar in Atlanta, was detonated. The police were then able to forensically link all of these 3 bombings together. In 1989, a man was seen fleeing the scene of a bombing outside of an abortion clinic in Birmingham, Alabama. This explosion killed an off-duty cop. The man was then identified as Eric Robert Rudolph. And before I go in further into Eric Robert Rudolph, what are your impressions just from the crimes that he has committed?
So, when I first thought it was... So, let's go back to the guy, Jewel.
Yes.
Going back to the Jewel guy, like, the first thing that always comes to my mind with people that are trying to be, like you were saying, like a cop, because that's a person that's, like, supposed to be helping people. I mean, it also seems like he has, like, some pretty severe control issues, but there's this thing called the savior complex, which a lot of times those type of people are always putting other people in front of their needs. And they're wanting to, they basically justify it as, it's the right thing to do, it's the noble thing to do, I have to do this to help other people. Which I don't know enough about him to be able to say for sure that's what he is doing. But from the sounds of it, he wants the media and the attention for helping, and if that makes sense.
Yeah, so it actually came out after he was cleared that he had never once reached out to any media outlet. He was doing interviews, but he never reached out to them. He only did interviews for people that reached out to him. So, to me, I feel like it seems more like he just really it seems like he wants to genuinely, like, help people. Whether he's going about that in the correct way is, you know, questionable, but I definitely feel like there's nothing super, like, nefarious about him or anything.
Right. Because before you told me that he was by the GBI person, I immediately was like, oh, he's a suspect. Especially if he's, like, wanting to be there if something happens. And, like, that's just telltale signs pointing to that. But if he has like an alibi, then obviously.
Right. So yeah, what do you think about the actual bomber, this Eric Robert Rudolph character, before I tell you more about him?
Well, he's specifically targeting things that are controversial, like the abortion clinic and the lesbian clinic and the
lesbian clinic.
The lesbian
where you
club.
Go to become a lesbian.
I don't know. He's just attacking marginalized groups.
Yeah, so
that's all I'm gonna say for right now.
So it comes out that at the time of the Olympic bombing, he was 29 years old. He was wearing blue jeans and a blue short sleeve shirt, carrying a green military Alice pack with 3 pipe bombs filled with gunpowder, and like I said, 6 pounds of 2.5-inch nails. He was seen by multiple people that day because he stuck out and people noticed his huge backpack, because this isn't just a normal sized backpack. It was very large, and so people remembered seeing him. So a little more about Rudolph is, so he was kind of a survivalist. Like, he lived in rural North Carolina, rural Western North Carolina. He was a reader of hate-filled propaganda, denouncing gays, abortion, the government, pretty much everything you could think of. He was also involved with a literal Nazi dude who I'll talk about in a minute. He didn't have a social security number. He only worked jobs for cash. He didn't pay taxes. He grew weed. 2 months prior to the bombings, he had told his family that he was moving to Colorado, but actually just stayed in North Carolina and, like, lived off the grid. It was later found out that he was kind of involved with a man named Nord Davis Jr., who was one of the leaders of the Christian Identity Movement, which is, like, basically a literal Nazi group, so all pieces of trash, throw them right away. Nord Davis Jr. was known to repeatedly say that the movement needed a lone wolf to plan an attack, which it's been said that that Eric took that to heart. When Eric Robert Rudolph was seen fleeing the scene of the bombing in Birmingham, Alabama, that had killed an off-duty cop, he disappeared into the mountains of North Carolina for almost 5 years. He was on the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitive list, and he was eventually arrested. I thought this was kind of funny. He was arrested while rummaging through a dumpster behind a grocery store in rural North Carolina.
Of course.
What a classy way to be arrested.
Covered in trash. Oh, I mean, the police are taking out the trash then. Nice.
On April 13th, 2005, Rudolph pleaded guilty to all of the bombings and was sentenced to 4 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. And
how long are life sentences?
I think it depends on the state, but it's usually 25 years, I believe.
And so how is that a life sentence if it's not like a lifespan?
Well, I mean, I could be wrong.
Consult the Google. I guess, would it matter on the age of the person? Like, if they're, like, 50, 25 years would put you at 75, which I think our average lifespan is about 75 years old.
Okay, so a life sentence can depend, but usually in the United States, it means at least 15 years with the chance of parole. So after 15 years, you can be eligible for parole. But since he was sentenced to 4 life sentences without the possibility of parole, I think that he would just not get out. But the reason that it's like usually like 15 or 25 years or whatever is because the life expectancy for a prisoner is way lower than for a regular person, because the living conditions in prisons are so horrible. Even in the United States, your life expectancy is just much shorter. So for someone to, you know, even if they're given like a life sentence with possibility of parole after 15 years, they can, you know, they'd get to 15 years, like, they might not even last that long in prison. So especially since you really consider, like, normally to be tried as an adult, you would have to be at least 18. They can make exceptions to that, but for the most part, to be tried as an adult, you're 18. You know, add years to that, I guess. I don't know. It's not like it starts from when you're born or something like that, so.
Right.
So they had the agents that arrested him had asked or had been asked how he was surviving, and apparently he had a bunch of 55-gallon barrels buried in the ground full of grain, soy, and oats. There was a granary about 4 miles from where he was camping. He would go there and steal grains at night. He always traveled at night. He'd fill up the 55-gallon barrels with food, and he foraged around the restaurants. He got to know the patterns, so in the winters, he would know which cabins were vacant in the winter, and he could, like, break in and stay in the cabins and, you know, find out when the grocery stores, like, throw out their produce or whatever, and he would go get that.
I know, this guy's, like, a really bad person, but that's super smart.
I mean, super smart and bad person aren't mutually exclusive.
I mean, like, that's some next level.
But yeah, thinking. I mean, he was able to evade detection for 5 years just living in rural North Carolina. But apparently in this area of, like, western North Carolina, in the, like, Appalachia area, there's a lot of issues with, like, white supremacy and anti-Semitism movements and stuff like that. But yeah, so what's your opinion now that you know all of the facts?
So you were saying that he would just go and stay in random people's cabins during the winter. What do you think would happen on the off chance that someone actually came up to that cabin while he was staying in there?
I mean, I don't know. He proved that he didn't care if people died, so maybe he would have tried to hurt them, or I guess we'll never really know. What do you think about his, like, state of mind? Like, how does somebody get mixed up in these kind of, like, cults that just breed hate?
Because the thing with cults is they find something that speaks to you. It could be one thing, like, maybe he's super against abortion, he's, like, all pro-life, and if that's something that they hardcore believe in, they're gonna get him. It's like religion, where they are like, oh, pray to this God and you'll be forgiven for every bad thing that you've done. It's the same thing with cults. Let's, using an example, he's pro-life. Like, that could have, anything like that could have drug him into this situation where all of these things become okay because of the one thing that he joined the situation for is allowing the rest of the situation to be okay. Like, they're just like, oh, he has common beliefs with what's going on.
Oh, okay.
Is that making sense? If you watch the, I don't know if you've seen the Scientology documentary, but
I love a good cult documentary.
It's with Leah. It's with Leah Remini, but they talk about how they joined Scientology there's people that joined it because they had similar interests and similar beliefs as to what the leader of Scientology was, which his name is L. Ron Hubbard, I believe. And
yeah.
When you actually sit down and look at the rules and everything like that, it's a big money-making scheme and basically a reason for L. Ron Hubbard to be a pedophile. But that's beside the point of this, what we're talking about. But that same belief is that there was a common thing that they were interested in. In that case, it was being saved by something. But in his case, there had to be something that was a common belief that he was working towards the better good of, like, it has to be something with the marginalized groups. Like I was saying, you know, being pro-life or being anti-gay, like you were saying, and those different types of groups that he's in. So that must have been thinking that he was, like, a savior for getting rid of these types of groups. Basically, like, eradicate them. Making a statement.
Yeah, that's weird. I don't get it. I mean, like, I get it, but
why does anyone believe in anything? Like, why do some people believe in God while others don't, you know?
Okay, I sent you the Google Doc link, and if you scroll down to the bottom, I have pictures of them. So there's the two guys, of Jewel and the guy that actually was the bomber, Rudolph. So there's the FBI 10 Most Wanted picture poster thing. that has pictures of Eric, Rob, or Rudolph, and then the one below that is Jewel. If you scroll all the way down to, like, the last page, there's two pictures. So there's the FBI 10 Most Wanted Fugitives poster. That's the pictures of Eric, Robert, Rudolph. And then the picture below that is of the Jewel guy. He kind of looks like a guy that really wants to be a cop.
He kind of looks like a gopher. First impression.
But yeah, so like from a psychology perspective, how much of an influence do you think Rudolph being like so isolated from society had? Or do you think it's like a personality disorder he was born with that caused him to do this?
So you're not necessarily born with a personality disorder. You can be predisposed to it and genetically inherit it from parts of your family, but a lot that has to do with personality disorders is like chronic stress or dealing with things in the household as you're growing up. So it's not necessarily like you're born with this and that you are going to have that personality disorder. It can develop even if you don't have the genetic trait for it. I'm like 99% sure he has narcissistic personality disorder, but
why do you really say that?
Because of narcissists do a lot of things for attention, and even if it's indirect attention, he's still getting the attention from what's going on, and they don't really feel bad about their actions. So him going into hiding for 5 years tells you he didn't really have a lot of guilt about the situation. I almost wonder if he was being led or like guided by the person that he was in cahoots with.
I mean, I definitely have some opinions on that, and I wouldn't be shocked at all, because these like radicalized Christianity cult groups do like absolutely insane shit. But from, so it also came out later that Rudolph had planned to do 5 consecutive days of bombings at the Olympics, but due to like obviously the response to it, he like kind of freaked out and went back and hid in the mountains of North Carolina for a while until he felt prepared to do his next bombing. So he kind of like went back on his plan because he was almost like afraid of attention, I feel like. Or do you think it was just afraid to be caught?
I think that it's afraid to be caught more than I think it would be easier for me to, because looking at it on paper, you can tell, or you can say that he's diagnosed with like 50 different things, but it's more like to diagnose someone, you also have to see them in person and see them, how they're acting and reacting is a big thing too. Because realistically, I could also say that he's a sociopath and then like his plan wasn't working out. So that's how he rationalized what he was doing, by going in the woods for 5 years and just basically abandoning everyday life. Sociopaths are also prone to, a lot of people think that since it falls under antisocial personality disorder that they don't have emotions or they lack them. A sociopath does have emotions, but they're presented in a different way. They are very hot-headed and impulsive and can be prone to anger and rage. They have a hard time with work and family life, and they can form emotional attachments, but it's extremely difficult. And they do make it clear that they do not care how other people feel, so I will say that too.
He did say that he, when he, like, pled guilty, he said that he has absolutely no remorse for these crimes. So, what's the difference between a sociopath and a psychopath? I feel like I've heard this, like, multiple times, but it's like me trying to explain to you what a phenotype is. I just never really understand it.
Psychopaths tend to be more manipulative. Okay, so like the Ted Bundy case. You've heard of that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so he's really charming.
What kind of true crime aficionado would I be if I hadn't heard of the Ted Bundy case?
Well, okay, so let's go with Dr. Death because I just watched that with you.
Okay, yeah.
I can't remember. Remind me of his name.
Dunch. Christopher Dunch.
Okay, so Chris is very charming and manipulative and able to get people to do what he wants, even if it's, like, I don't know if the person listening to this is knowing of the show Dr. Death or the documentary on it, but
there's also a podcast about it.
Yes. He knows what to say to get people to do what he wants, for the most part, until people start seeing what's actually going on, because they start to kind of unravel a little bit when things get too intense. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
They're able to kind of, like, lead a normal life, but not really lead a normal life. And then also, the Dr. Death guy is an absolute narcissist. Like I was telling you the other day about how he's, like, saying, oh, at the end when he's saying, it's Dr. Dunch, and she's like, she corrects herself, but then she's like, at the end of it, like, you're not a doctor anymore. But he gets, like, really mad about it. And then they have to plead, like, that he's incompetent when he's, sorry, I'm spoiling the show, but he's incompetent to prove that he's not guilty. That he
He doesn't want to, because he doesn't want to say that he's incompetent.
Right, because that would be admitting that he has faults, and narcissists don't believe that they have faults, or they're very limited in faults, because they're better than everyone else.
So, in this case, if Rudolph is, the bomber, is a sociopath, do you think that, Norda Davis Jr. guy, like, one of the leaders of the radical, like, church group or whatever, do you feel like he could potentially be a psychopath who was, like, manipulating Rudolph, or what's your opinion on that?
He would definitely fall under psychopath over sociopath, because sociopaths are more erratic and, like, acting on anger, but it's not, like, they're not really able to lead as much of a normal life as psychopaths would, and they're not charismatic. They're very deadpan.
Okay.
So someone like
L.
Ron Hubbard or David Miscavige, they're basically anyone that is, I hate to just trash on religion, but, like, anyone that is, like, in charge, like a pastor or somebody, whatever it is, what is the thing called that when they get together? Congregation. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
When the congregation is listening to the pastor, they are literally listening to a leader. And if they are not a good pastor, the people won't listen and will eventually act against them. There will still be some people that are, like, diehard religious, but other people will be like, oh, this is not a very good pastor.
Right.
You know, like, so if they're off preaching about, let's say it's, like, an all-inclusive church for LGBT and, like, all of that kind of stuff. And if they're off preaching about how they're anti-gay and anti-this and anti-that, it's not going to sit well with the crowd.
Right.
So they're
side
not
note,
being...
Side note about... So I grew up in a very religious home. We went to church 4 times a week, twice on Sundays, on Wednesdays, and then either Mondays or Fridays, and never really missed a day ever, not even when we went on vacation. So I grew up very religious. The church I grew up in wasn't, like, a mega church, but it was pretty sizable. We had, like, several hundred people in church usually on Sundays when I was pretty young. And then there was this whole drama where, like, the church, for one reason or another, like, fired the preacher. And it, like, dead split the church in half. Like, half the church left and went to and followed the preacher, and they were doing, like, church sermons in his backyard with, like, 150 people. It split the church, like, right down the middle, and it was weird. It was just, like, people who have been going to seeing each other, best friends, every week for years and years and years are all of a sudden, like, about to, like, at each other's throats, like, about to, like, fight over it. And I was just like, what is happening?
Because it's a differing of opinion. One person is all in on it, and the other person is like, hey, something's not right. But I have an example of back in Michigan, there was a a, I think he was a pastor, yeah. But he was at a church. He was a big pastor, well known. Everyone loved him. But it came out that he was abusing children. Well, most people, I mean, he got removed from the church, obviously, but most people were like,
I don't even know if you should include the obviously in there, because you'd think it would be obvious, but okay, there's a documentary that I'm going to need to make you watch, CJ. it's, maybe we'll cover the case too in on the show. So maybe I won't tell you the name of the documentary because you'll probably go watch it. It took place in Baltimore and Baltimore City and County, and it's this whole thing about clergy abusing younger people, and it's a whole thing. So the Catholic Church just covered it up for years and years. So, you know, I hope that we could say obviously, but
yeah, I guess I shouldn't say obviously, but he got removed from the church and he was married and he had children, and it was just a whole thing. And I remember this because my friend, her mom was is still a diehard Christian, but she went to this church and my friend went to this church, and I actually met this guy too. And I didn't like him. I didn't get a good vibe from him. I didn't want to talk to him. He was very anti-gay. And I was just like, I'm done with this. I'm never coming back here again. And then I
listen
remember,
to the vibes, people. Listen to the vibes.
I remember a year or two later, this came out about him. And I was like, ah, yes. And her mom, my friend was like, no, we'll never support this guy again. It's not okay. This is not right. You know, you shouldn't do that, especially when you're the leader of a church. And her mom was diehard all about it. She was like, oh, people make mistakes. And you know, it's fine. He made one mistake. And just, but that's because she believed into everything that he was saying. He was her religious leader.
I'm sorry, man, though. Yeah, people make mistakes, but you don't get to claim molesting children is a one mistake and absolve people of that. No.
Exactly.
But yeah, I just,
people,
I don't
like
know,
to just pick and choose what they believe in, and I really, really press it to people that they should watch that Scientology documentary, because it really gives you,
it's really good,
insight into cult mentality.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I can attest to it a little bit. The church I grew up in wasn't super radical or anything like that. Nothing super insane, but you know, you're brainwashed with it. I literally went to church 4 times a week from the time I was born till the time I was 18 and I had a job and I had to miss church on Sundays sometimes because I was working. And then when I moved off to college, I stopped going to church as well. And I'm not directly bashing religion, because I think that for some people it's a really good influence in their life. And if you are using religion as a method of spirituality, but still forming your own opinions and not just blindly listening to things that are told to you, I think it can be a really good thing. It's not for me, but I think it can be a really good thing and a positive influence in people's life. However, your girl got some trauma. The church that I grew up in was very much, you know, if a boy does anything sexual before marriage, boys will be boys. You should try not to, but it's really on the girls because they were showing off their legs or, you know, their shoulders or whatever. It's fine. But if a girl does anything sexual before marriage, she is broken, damaged goods. Nobody's ever going to want you. You are dirty and horrible and blah, blah, blah. So.
And that's on misogyny.
Yay. It all works together.
See, but that's why you see so many male leaders, because.
Well, my church did not allow female leadership at all. And that's a pretty common thing in churches still, at least within Christianity.
When I attended church for a very brief amount of time, I went to a Methodist church, and we actually had a lady that was our pastor, and I still know her personally, and she's a very nice person, very, very different from any other pastor I've ever met. She's very charismatic, but at the same time, she's very real with you.
So my cousin is actually going to officiate my wedding in April, and she is a woman. But, I mean, we're also not getting married in a church or anything like that. So my cousin went to theology school, I guess it's called, like church school where you would go to be a preacher, and specifically studied feminism in Catholicism. Like, I think it's just super cool and interesting. She's a huge advocate for, like, women to be able to be leaders in churches and stuff like that. And that's the way that I see church as a positive thing. If it's really encouraging you to show love to everyone and, you know, lift up those who have been put down and, you know, follow what Jesus says to do, like, love thy neighbor. I think it can be a really good influence, but we've long gone off the rails about talking about this case, though.
I was about to circle back to it, but I just want to close out our whole segment, tangent, whatever, about religion. Practice what you want, do what you want, but don't let it harm other people. You can believe whatever you want, but don't inflict your beliefs on another person, unless it is consensual. That is not okay. I hate it when any religion tries to force themselves onto other people. That is not okay.
Yeah.
Kind of circling back to the true crime case we were talking about. Like I said, I think I would have to see Rudolph kind of in action. But he either falls on the sociopath or psychopath spectrum, because they kind of overlap for the most part. But there's very different, like I was saying, a sociopath is not going to be charming and all of that kind of stuff. They're going to be kind of deadpan. And like, whereas you were saying that he said that he didn't have remorse for his actions, that could potentially fall under either, because both of those personality disorders have that common theme. He's, to me, falling more under sociopath because of following the
anti-Semitic cult. The leader of the cult was like saying that Jews were Satan's children and that they needed to be eradicated from the earth before Jesus would come back to save everybody. And I was like, first of all, you clearly have never read the Bible, my dude. Just saying.
Yeah, but every religion has their, that is revolving around Christianity, has their own interpretation of the Bible. So everything is
subjective. Right, but like all of the religions that surround, that like go around the Bible say that the Jews are the original, like, chosen people of God.
Yes, but in their minds, or the guy's mind, I guess, he, like, you could tell someone the sky is blue and they could interpret it as the sky is dark blue, the sky is light blue, the sky is, you know, any of those things. So he could see that in the original Bible, twist it into his own narrative, and then start preaching about it and convincing people that he is correct.
Oh, which is what happens. Yeah, it's like with anything, you find something to identify as the enemy, the reason that everything is going to shit, something that you can blame everything on and direct everyone's anger towards that. It's right. The exact same strategy Trump used throughout his entire I almost said pregnancy presidency. It's probably because my brain was like, we really don't want to talk about his presidency.
Yeah, so I definitely think he would fall more towards sociopath, because he's kind of just following like a drive. But also, if he is okay with being alone for 5 years and not having much human interaction, that's not, I'm not gonna say it's not a normal thing, it's just like not a typical thing. People need human interaction, or they can, let's say, become more mentally ill than they were before.
What do you think Do you think that he was kind of destined to be on this path of, like, harming people or destruction from birth? Or do you think that this was something that was more developed later in life as, like, a result of him kind of getting in with this cult group?
So, if you were to study his childhood, I cannot remember what it is called for the kids, but there's a thing called conduct disorder. Conduct disorder is basically you're being defiant of laws and rules and that kind of stuff. And if you catch it early, so the kid version is oppositional defiance disorder, and then it turns into conduct disorder.
Okay.
Oppositional defiance disorder is generally, did you ever see Toy Story?
I think so.
Do you remember the kid, his name is Sid, and he has like a black shirt with a skull on it and he's evil?
Oh yeah.
Okay, so Sid has ODD or oppositional defiance disorder, where he goes out of his way, people or kids with ODD go out of their way to harm things, like it could be small animals, that's how they start off, and they are outright like ignoring the feelings of other kids, or you know, they kind of like could turn into the bully. They're not good at fitting into social norms, and they could be committing physical violence acts or other things like that, which if ODD is not treated and they become an adult, then it turns into conduct disorder, which conduct disorder is like a big kid version of ODD, where they can turn to illegal or dangerous behavior, such as, you know, bombings and things like that. They can have a difficult time holding down a job or maintaining relationships. And also it can sometimes be diagnosed as antisocial personality disorder or as being a sociopath. So
to be clear, those are different diagnoses, but sometimes they're misdiagnosed?
Yes.
Okay.
So it could be possible that when he was a kid, he had ODD, which went untreated and was just treated like the bad kid. Again, we don't know his childhood, so this is all speculation. And as he grew up, he normalized these behaviors as what he's supposed to be doing and that they're okay, because they might not have been corrected or they were corrected in the wrong way, which then becomes conduct disorder as he becomes an adult, which I said, you know, it's like the big kid version of ODD. And you become more destructive and more against social norms and less remorse for your actions. It's a scary thing, but at the same time, that's how they normalize their world. Like, this is okay because this is how I grew up. Does that make sense?
Right, like, kind of like I got away with this as a kid, so it's fine.
Basically, but it also needs to be corrected with behavioral therapy. So it's not like they're just going to go in and sit down and talk about life, because it's not going to make that big of a difference. They basically have to reframe their thinking.
Or like, can you talk just a bit about like what behavioral therapy entails?
There's different types of behavioral therapy.
Like, just a general description.
Okay, so I'm going to just give you the definition of behaviorism and try and make it as simple as possible. So, have you heard of B.F. Skinner at all?
Yes. I did take a psychology class in college, but it was just, like, Psych 101.
Okay.
So, like, I recognized the name, but, like, couldn't tell you what he did or anything. But since you mentioned him, I'm assuming he is, like, a part of behavioralism or whatever.
Yeah, behaviorism. So the Skinner box experiment basically outlines the types of reinforcements that there are, as well as operant conditioning, which is basically getting someone to do the thing that you want them to do and try and get them to stop doing the behavior that you don't want them to do, if that makes sense. The Skinner box experiment did this with a rat or a pigeon in some parts of the experiments, but basically, the premise applies that the rat did what the speaker said, and they got the reward. If they didn't do that, then they don't get the reward. And then there's the neutral stimulus, which is nothing happens. So if the individual that we are talking about were to have gone to therapy for ODD, they probably would have recommended what's called cognitive behavioral therapy. It's extremely popular. It's just combining behavioral therapy with cognitive therapy. Treatment is around how someone's thoughts and beliefs influence their actions and moods, and it often focuses on a person's current problems and how to solve them. So in his case, it would be dealing with his anger and all of those type of emotional issues that are going on. There may have been other things that were going on as well in his life that we didn't know about. The long-term goal of this, though, is to change a person's thinking and behavioral patterns to healthier ones. So basically to get him to stop inflicting pain onto animals and all of that kind of fun stuff that he was doing. But obviously, here we are and learning about this case, and that type of treatment was not there, considering, or I guess if that were true, that he has ODD or conduct disorder. Just speculation. In a lot of experiments, they use rats because they're intelligent and are easily studied, which I'm sorry for the people that love rats and all that kind of stuff, but it happens, unfortunately.
Yeah, rats are really cute, but, you know, we can't just go right from testing things on, you know, theoretically to testing them on humans.
I'm just gonna give my general thoughts on the case and then we can close out.
Okay.
Overall, I definitely think this guy has some mental health issues. Is he still alive now?
I'm not sure. He was in 1996, he was 28, I think. And that was 25 years ago. So it's, you know, it's fairly, at least like, likely-ish that he's still alive. He wouldn't be, like, ancient.
I just wonder how he's doing adjusting to the civilization in prison. Not that I'm siding with him. It would just be interesting to see how he's responding to that. I just want to see how he would fit into that. Anyway, that's a totally different thing.
Yes, he is still alive. He is 54 years old, serving his life sentence at the ADX Florence Supermax Prison in Colorado.
I wonder if it's more torturous for him to be amongst a community of people rather than just being in isolation. You know how they put them in, I don't know what they're called. I mean, I watched, yeah.
Solitary confinement.
I was going to say the shoe because that's from Orange is the New Black, but.
Oh, I've only watched like half an episode of that, and then I was I don't like this. Okay, so I found a little bit about his childhood if you want me to share. So he was born on September 19th, 1966, in Merritt Island, Florida. He grew up with parents who were, like, pacifists. His parents met while they were both protesting against the Vietnam War. Christianity was also a huge part of the family's life, but Rudolph's father died of cancer in 1981 when he was 15 years old. This article says that that fostered his anger at God as well as the government, because they didn't approve a risky drug that Rudolph firmly believed would have saved his father. His widowed mother then moved the family to North Carolina, where his radicalization arguably began. Eric Rudolph, as an impressionable teenager, spent a lot of time with his neighbor, Thomas Wayne Branham. His friend detested the government and always kept an arsenal of dangerous weapons on hand. When Rudolph was 17, his friend Branham actually got raided by the ATF, which is the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Rudolph had already dropped out of high school by the age of 17. On Branham's suggestion, he had spent 4 months with an anti-Semitic, racist, and homophobic preacher in Missouri, which I'm assuming is the guy we were talking about. He later returned to North Carolina to get his GED and attend college. He then dropped out to join the U.S. Army. He was stationed in Kentucky where he learned quite a bit about explosives. He was discharged for marijuana use in 1989. He then returned to North Carolina and worked in carpentry while becoming increasingly paranoid about the government. Throughout the years, he explored various types of white supremacist, anti-Semitic, and anti-gay groups, most notably Christian Identity, a movement whose most fundamental teachings pivots on the idea that Anglo-Saxons are the direct descendants of the 10 lost tribes of Israel and thus the true chosen people of God. I feel like there are definitely some cases where you're like, where like you hear about like serial killers and they grew up in like pretty much like the perfect home life, and you know, sometimes in those cases it's like easy to lean on and be like, oh well, it must have been something like wrong with him, not like how he's raised. But in this one, like, it seems like there was a lot of outside influences that kind of put him on this path as well. So like, it makes me wonder if like, if there had been an intervention at some point in this scenario, if it might have altered his course. Like, you know, we could sit here and talk ifs all day, but it just, like, makes me wonder, you know?
But anyway, I agree with you that if there had been early intervention, it may have helped, because if the parents didn't know who he was surrounding himself with, it's likely that this person that he was friends with definitely influenced from an early age. Having that charismatic personality and that kind of stuff to get him to do bad things. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah. Do you have any other opinions about the case?
I think justice was served, and it's really funny that he was found in a dumpster.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of funny, too. Yeah, I don't know. I definitely tend to be pretty skeptical of police cases. I just feel like there is so many wrongful convictions, and we need to do better, but, I mean, I feel like this guy is definitely, they got the right guy.
Yeah, it seems pretty cut and dry, especially if he admitted to it.
Yeah. Yeah, he pled guilty to all of them, said he had no remorse. Oh yeah, he had also buried, like, giant caches of dynamite places. I don't know.
Wow.
But yeah, thank you for joining us. CJ, thank you for your insight.
Yeah, I tried. Hopefully next time I'll be pretty prepared and it won't be super late, but
there wasn't a ton of, like, forensic evidence for me to dissect this time, but we'll get there.
It's our first attempt, so we're figuring it out.
Well, I mean, there's not going to be a ton of forensic evidence in every case. A lot of cases tend to be circumstantial or, you know, whatever. But yeah, thank you guys so much for joining us on the first episode of True Crime with Millennials. If you haven't already, you should check us out on social media. CJ, do you want to tell them what our social media is?
So, if you know us from Science with Millennials, of course I'm going to plug it. We're Science with Millennials on Instagram. Or I created a new Instagram that will be coming out when this comes out. And it is just True Crime with Millennials. So you can follow us there and at Science with Millennials.
And also, if you haven't listened to our Science with Millennials podcast, you definitely should. If you like cool science things explained in a way that's easy to understand, you will enjoy it. And I also think that you should give us as many stars as possible on whatever podcast platform you're listening to this on, because it's almost Christmas. Be in the giving spirit, people.
Also, our science podcast is a little bit more structured. This one's just like a little bit more open forum, but it definitely is enjoyable, and we have a lot of Rachel rants that you'll hear.
I'm sure there will be a lot of Rachel rants on this podcast too. I just like to rant, and I have a lot of opinions.
Looking forward to it.
Anyway, thank you guys so much for hanging out, and we will catch you next time with another case.
Catch you on the flip side.
Bye.
Later, tater.
Did you just say later, tater?